Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Election wins give Republicans control of U.S. Congress. And Ukraine stops funding for rebel-held regions. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. Republicans have recaptured control of the U.S. Senate and expanded their edge in the House of Representatives, giving them a majority in both houses of Congress for the final 2 years of President Barack Obama's presidency. Democrats held 55 of the Senate's 100 seats before Tuesday's congressional elections, but Republicans gained at least 7 seats. The results were a stinging rebuff to Mr. Obama, who was not on the ballot but said that his policies were. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who easily won his re-election bid, is said to become the Senate Majority Leader. He promised to seek agreement with Mr. Obama on some issues, but also vowed to continue the Republican effort to diminish the size of the national government.
Friends, this experiment in big government has lasted long enough. It's time to go in a new direction.
While taking over Senate control come January, Republicans added at least 13 seats in the 435-member House, where they already held 233 seats. Ukraine on Wednesday announced it will halt government funding to its eastern regions controlled by Russian-backed separatists. Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said Wednesday the cutoff will apply as long as the territories of Donetsk and Luhansk are controlled by terrorists. Mr. Yatsenyuk said the government would continue to supply gas and electricity to the area. The self-declared breakaway regions on Sunday defied Ukraine by holding elections meant to assert their autonomy from Kiev. This is VOA News. Delegation of West African leaders is in Burkina Faso trying to defuse a political crisis set off by the departure of longtime President Blaise Compaoré. The presidents of Ghana, Nigeria, and Senegal arrived in Ouagadougou on Wednesday and went into meetings with Burkinabe political and religious leaders, including the country's military-appointed interim president, Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida. A reporter for VOA on the scene says the heads of state have asked politicians, religious leaders, and civil society groups to each name 3 candidates to lead a transitional government. Burkina Faso's military took control of the country Friday after Mr. Compaoré resigned and fled the country following violent protests against an effort to extend his rule. Israeli police say a Palestinian man has rammed a car into a crowd of pedestrians in Jerusalem in a deliberate attack that injured 10 people, including at least 3 police officers. A local hospital says one of the officers later died. Authorities said the car hit a train platform Wednesday. Then the man got out to attack people with a metal pole. Police shot him dead. The attack comes 2 weeks after a similar incident in the same area. Just days before U.S. President Barack Obama travels to China for a regional summit, a prominent state-run paper there is accusing him of being an ineffective leader who has done an insipid job in office. The editorial in the Global Times was published just hours before President Obama's Democratic Party lost control of the U.S. Senate, meaning the rival Republican Party now controls both houses of Congress. President Obama is in Beijing next week for an Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, where he is expected to hold one-on-one meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping. China is threatening to punish Communist Party members loyal to exiled Tibetan spiritual leader the Dalai Lama, whom Beijing regards as a dangerous separatist. Ye Dongsong, with the party's internal discipline watchdog, warned Tibet authorities to focus on neutralizing separatists and maintaining social stability. His comments were published in the Global Times, which quoted analysts who said some officials in Tibet still sympathize with the Dalai Lama because of their religious beliefs. The article provided no estimation of how many Communist Party officials have sympathies or links with the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader. More than 130 Tibetans have set themselves on fire since 2009. Tibetans are protesting Chinese rule and what they view as government repression of their religion and culture. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Whether the deployment of a vaccine that's effective would have a significant impact on ending the outbreak is an open question. I think its primary immediate impact would be actually on some of the things that would happen outside of the outbreak.
That's Dr. Armand Sprecher. He's a public health specialist with Doctors Without Borders. Details coming up. Also in the news, three West African leaders are in Burkina Faso to push army leaders to honor their pledge to hand over power to a civilian transitional government. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, three West African leaders are in Burkina Faso to push army leaders to honor their pledge to hand over power to a civilian transitional government. Ghana's President John Mahama, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, and Senegalese President Macky Sall arrived in the capital Ouagadougou today. The presidents are expected to meet with Burkina Faso's interim leader, Lieutenant Colonel Issac Zida, as well as leaders of the opposition. The military took control Friday after President Blaise Compaoré resigned and fled to neighboring Ivory Coast. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara said yesterday that Mr. Compaoré is in good spirits and can stay as long as he wants. Mr. Zida has said several times the military will quickly hand over power. On Monday, the African Union warned that Burkina Faso faces possible sanctions unless a civilian government takes power within 2 weeks. Before his resignation Friday, Blaise Compaoré led Burkina Faso for 27 years. An attempt to extend his rule ended in failure last week when protesters burned parliament hours before lawmakers were due to vote on a measure eliminating term limits.
Well, while meeting in Cotonou, Benin, the World Health Organization's Africa region picked a longtime veteran to take charge of operations in Africa. Dr. Matshidiso Maiti of Botswana will replace Dr. Luis Sambo, who resigned recently. Sambo was recently criticized in an internal draft document circulating in Geneva headquarters for his handling of the Ebola crisis. Officials in Geneva have since taken direct control of the Ebola campaign in West Africa, but Maiti is expected to manage all other regional operations. Maiti previously led the epidemiology department in Botswana and the AIDS department. She previously served as the deputy regional director and as a regional advisor and headed their office in Malawi.
In Australia, Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced that his government has pledged $17 million to build a 100-bed Ebola treatment center for Ebola patients in Sierra Leone. Mr. Abbott said a private firm will staff and operate the Ebola center and the facilities being built in the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister said no Australian government health workers would be sent to the West African crisis. He said the UK has offered to treat any Australians who contract the virus while working in West Africa. Australia has maintained a hands-off in the Ebola crisis since the government in Canberra suspended visas for anyone trying to visit Australia from Ebola-affected countries.
The Committee to Protect Journalists and the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists have protested the arrest of a radio reporter in Freetown under presidential emergency orders of the Ebola crisis. Sierra Leone police arrested David Tambayo for incitement on Monday. Chief Police Superintendent Ibrahim Karoma said Tambayo was placed in Bamenda Maximum Security Prison on an executive order of President Ernest Bai Koroma. The police chief did not identify specific charges against the reporter. Tambayo conducts popular radio programs on Citizen FM radio, in which he questioned arrest made last week following Ebola-linked riots in Kono District. He has also challenged Mr. Bai Koroma's wish to turn for a third term as president. Tambayo was arrested of sedition in January, and the reporter's monologue show was previously banned for 2 months. In Madrid, the head of a hospital treating a nurse for Ebola said Teresa Moramo has recovered from an Ebola infection and was released today. The nurse contracted the virus while treating two priests who were infected in Sierra Leone. The priest died. Romero's was the first case of a patient being infected with the virus outside of Africa. She spent a month receiving hospital treatment. In Anqi, China, the U.S.-based Lakeland Industries is producing 6,000 personal protective suits daily at a manufacturing plant in Shandong Province for use by health workers in West Africa. The disposable yellow garment is made of polyethylene and polypropylene and is completely sealed to maintain a virus-free environment for workers. Plant manager said they plan to double their production in January.
Leading researchers and public health experts held a briefing today on the West Africa Ebola crisis. The briefing was held in the southern U.S. city of New Orleans at the annual meeting of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. Dr. Armand Sprecher is a public health specialist with Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. He was asked how much of an impact an effective vaccine would have on the Ebola outbreak.
Whether the deployment of a vaccine that's effective would have a significant impact on ending the outbreak is an open question. I think its primary immediate impact would be actually on some of the things that would happen outside of the outbreak. If we had healthcare workers that were able to resume work in their healthcare centers and their hospitals and start delivering babies, doing cesarean sections, treating malaria, it may save many, many lives. The number of people that are dying of non-Ebola causes at the time is unknown. We're trying to measure it, but the suspicion is that it probably is much larger than the people that are actually dying of Ebola right now.
No time.
Leading the MSF physician describes of this the state of the healthcare system in Liberia's capital when he visited a few months ago.
When I was in Monrovia at the end of August, all of the secondary care, all of the hospitals had stopped admitting patients. So there was no inpatient care being delivered to a city of over 1 million people. We can draw conclusions about how many people suffered or died because of that. Right now we're trying to measure that. And hopefully in the coming weeks we'll have a better idea of the actual cost of that. Primary care has been significantly reduced through the official outlets, and this is one of the reasons that we are undertaking the mass distribution of antimalarials to just reduce the burden from at least one disease that's contributing to all of that.
Luciano Borio is leading the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's response to the Ebola outbreak. She addressed the issue of drugs that might be used to treat Ebola.
As you know, the desire for safe and effective products is overwhelming. And although the products are in the early stages of development, they are proceeding at an unprecedented pace and scale. And FDA is determined to do all we can to facilitate and expedite development of these products and to help developers meet their goals and timelines. It's a very urgent issue, and we need to learn what helps and what hurts at the soonest possible time and in the most definitive way. It's going to be important for generations to come, and we have to get this right. I'd like to say that we have an obligation to provide a lot more than hope. We need to provide safe and effective products at the soonest available time.
Ed Cox is director of the Office of Antimicrobial Products at the FDA.
Most of the products that are being developed are in very early stages at this point in time, and there is a tremendous urgency to figure out which among these therapies will help patients and do so and do it in a way that we can get it right. We at FDA have been discussing over the last several months a number of different clinical trial designs, and clearly in this setting we need to get to clinical trial designs that will allow us to get to the right answers quickly so that we can figure out what works and then incorporate those therapies that are found to be effective into the standard of care. We've been working a lot with our colleagues at NIAID, and they have developed a protocol that uses innovative statistical methods that allows for interim analysis to allow a winner to be declared very early for those things that demonstrate efficacy. And really, this type of trial design is novel for us. It's something different than what we've done before, but it's appropriate given what we're facing here with Ebola virus disease.
Ripley Ballou is with GlaxoSmithKline, the developer of one of the Ebola vaccine candidates now being tested. He was asked, who should pay for the vaccine research and development?
Given the early stage of this vaccine development, it's too early for us to say when and if this vaccine will be available. It obviously depends upon the data, the outcome of the clinical trials that are ongoing and will be planned, and the evaluation of those data by the regulators. As an example of what the kinds of things that are being done to accelerate this process so that we don't slow this down, we are taking, for example, an unusual step of running a phase two and a phase three program in parallel. And the FDA has agreed to review the data that come from these trials on a rolling basis, which will allow very quick decision-making when data become available.
Ballou says phase two and phase three trials on the Ebola vaccine candidate have not yet started.
The International Medical Aid Group, Doctors Without Borders, also known by the acronym MSF, said the Ebola situation in the three most affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, is still at a crisis level. To help prevent the virus from spreading, the group has been distributing protection kits to families in Liberia. However, a big question is posed in how to properly dispose of the contaminated gear. I spoke with Jose Mass, MSF Emergency Coordinator, who just left the DRC and is in Barcelona, Spain, about the proper use of protective equipment.
The idea behind these kits is just to prevent the families surrounding a patient or a suspect case to be infected. So the idea is to put in place all these precautions so that they are able to live their life without being at risk or minimizing the maximum possible risk. So it has to be matched with some sensitization from our teams just explaining how to use them. But the idea would be for them to use chlorine to disinfect all possible objects touched by the possible patient or suspect case, and to put on the different items like the mask, the goggles, or the gloves in order to be able to handle things without being at risk.
Now, these kits, they come in two buckets. As you say, they contain chlorine, soap, gloves, gowns, plastic bags, and a spray bottle, goggles, and mask. Is the use just a one-time use?
There are some items which are consumable and some others that can be reused. But this is not a perfect solution. I mean, the distribution of the kits, it's just to gain some time in order to allow the hospitals to host as many patients or suspect cases as possible. So the idea would be, for example, chlorine would be consumed, and hence probably in a few days it would be over. But the idea for the mask and the bucket and the rest of the items, it is that if they are disinfected with chlorine, with the solutions that have to be in place, then they could be reused for a few days. But again, this is a very temporal solution.
Once the materials are contaminated, how does the family properly dispose of it?
Depending on the surface where the Ebola virus is supposed to be impregnated, it depends on if it is an object. Normally, you would use chlorine solution of 0.5. This would kill the Ebola virus. You can use also to disinfect another solution, 0.05. But this is more used for some clothes or this kind of object if the amount of virus is not supposed to be high. If it is high, you have to always use the 0.5 solution, provided, of course, that it is not a human being. I mean, this is just for objects, these solutions. There is a third option, which would be water and soap. This is also known to kill the virus, as well as drying in the sun. After you have used the solutions, you can put all the objects or, for example, the clothes to dry in the sun, and this is also effective against the Ebola.
Once they have been treated, they can be disposed of just in the regular trash.
Usually, there are some protocols that should be followed. In order to minimize all the risks, it's not that it is advisable to dispose them as usual trash. In fact, in treatment centers, there are many different waste management procedures, and I'm pretty sure, because this information, I don't have it since I was in Congo until a couple of days ago, I'm not pretty sure of how the procedures will be disposed for all the families to get rid of the waste. But it is not that they should be doing as per normal basis in unusual ways. Usually there is another procedure in place.
Also, I understand these kits are not meant to replace the protection gear that is worn in isolation centers. How do people working in isolation centers, how do they get rid of protection suits that have been contaminated?
There is protocol that you have to follow in order to undress the personal protective equipment. There are some rules that you have to follow. There is an order by which you would be taking first the goggles, then the different items. And some of the items are directly disposable. I mean, you would not reuse them again. Some of the others, after being disinfected with chlorine solutions of 0.5 or 0.05, they can be reused. But some of them, it is only for one-shot event.
Do they need help when they get out of their suits?
Usually, it is possible to do it yourself, but you have to be always accompanied by what we call, this is a buddy system. So somebody is watching you out while you get dressed or while you get undressed, and the same the other way around. So when your colleague is getting dressed or undressed, you should be watching him up in order to prevent from making mistakes that is usual when you are tired or when you have been in the treatment center for a couple of hours.
Is there someone else who is watching the two buddies?
There is someone else who is usually somebody in charge of disinfecting, in charge of decontaminating all the different items and pointing out which would be the next step to take.
That was Jose Mas, MSF Emergency Coordinator. He spoke with me from Barcelona, Spain. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suheep, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Three West African leaders are in Burkina Faso to push army leaders to honor their pledge to hand over power to a civilian transitional government. And in Australia, Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced that his government has pledged $17 million to build a 100-bed Ebola treatment center for Ebola patients in Sierra Leone. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The World Health Organization says the ongoing polio vaccination campaign is facing resistance in Central African countries. The United Nations has been assisting six Central African countries in synchronized vaccinations after Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea reported more than a dozen cases of the wild polio virus in less than 3 years. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde on what is slowing down global efforts to eradicate the crippling childhood virus.
Healthcare workers deployed to vaccinate children at homes, schools, markets, and churches said they met stiff resistance to giving the inoculations due to misinformation and suspicion. Here in Cameroon, vaccination agent Ngambi Pierre tells VOA that he struggled in vain to convince a pastor of the Holy Ghost Revival Church in Eastern Cameroon, who said his faith is against vaccinations as solutions to health problems.
C'est beaucoup plus profond puisque ça touche déjà les problèmes de conscience. Certains pasteurs instruits éduquer, avertir.
He says the problem is becoming complex because certain parents are heeding calls from some religious leaders and refusing to have their children vaccinated. The root of the problem is misinformation, fear, and suspicion. Local media reports that some Nigerian refugees in northern Cameroon have refused the polio vaccine, claiming that it is a ploy by developed countries to inject people with chemicals that reduce fertility in order to reduce the population of Muslims. The director of the WHO Global Polio Eradication Initiative, Dr. Hamid Jafiri, says it is imperative to combat these mistaken beliefs with proven medical benefits across the globe.
I want to assure the families that this is a very, very safe vaccine. Every year, more than 2 billion doses of this vaccine is administered to children. So I would request the families that they should cooperate and in fact support the work of vaccinators who are coming door to door or meet them in the market. Because unless the families cooperate, unless the district administration cooperates, until the governors cooperate, it's going to be difficult to get rid of this virus.
Until a few years ago, polio had been eradicated in all but a few countries: Nigeria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. But conflict-driven mass refugee movements and poor sanitation have been mostly responsible for the re-emergence of polio in the Middle East and Africa, including Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and Ethiopia. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative says Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea have each reported 5 new cases this year. Polio is a virus which mainly strikes children under 5 years of age and can lead to irreversible paralysis and, in up to 10% of cases, death. Close to 30 years ago, polio afflicted more than 350,000 people a year. Since the WHO created the Global Polio Eradication Initiative in 1988, the number of cases of polio has declined by 99% to just 416 cases reported in 2013. Cameroon's public health minister, André Mamafuda, says despite the challenges, they are determined to eradicate the crippling disease.
J'invite tout le monde, enfants et adultes, à se faire vacciner pour permettre à nos enfants d'être renforcés contre les maladies.
He says he is inviting everyone to make sure that all children are vaccinated, because by so doing, lives are saved and preventable diseases are avoided. He adds that people should open their doors and receive vaccination teams. Last year, the Global Polio Eradication Initiative launched a new strategic plan to wipe out polio by 2018. More than $4 billion has been pledged to the effort, which requires that every child on earth be vaccinated. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Three West African leaders are in Burkina Faso to push army leaders to honor their pledge to hand over power to a civilian transitional government. Australia will help staff an Ebola treatment center in Sierra Leone. And the WHO says the ongoing polio vaccination campaign is facing resistance in Central African countries. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, closed roads and canceled flights because of Ebola keeps Liberians who have spent years abroad from returning. I'm Kim Lewis with Yuhayas Bouhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off on a sad note.
Kim, one of the year's saddest African football stories is the murder of Orlando Pirates goalkeeper Senzo Maiwa, who was shot to death in a robbery last month near Johannesburg, South Africa. Maiwa was regarded as a rising star, and he recently was named the captain of South Africa's national team, nicknamed Bafana Bafana. Joining us now from Johannesburg to talk about Maiwa's memorial service is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny, and good evening to all our listeners around Africa.
David, funeral services held over the weekend in South Africa's coastal city of Durban for Senzo Maiwa, the 27-year-old goalkeeper for Orlando Pirates and South Africa's national team, who was murdered October 26th in a robbery. Why was the funeral held in Durban rather than Soweto, where the Pirates play their home matches?
Right, Sonny, you're 100% on the nail there in that Pirates, of course, are based in Soweto. But Durban, on the Indian Ocean coast, is the hometown of Senzo Maiwa. What they did is they had the memorial service at Moses Mabhida Stadium, which is a 55,000 capacity ground. It was used during the 2010 World Cup. In fact, hosted one of the semifinals in which Spain beat Germany 1-0. And it's there, Sonny, in a couple of weeks' time that South Africa will play their final home match in the 2015 Cup of Nations. That match was originally scheduled for Nelspruit in the northeast of the country, but as a tribute to Senzo Maiwa, the South African Football Association have decided to move that game to Durban, to his hometown. They're clearly expecting a capacity crowd. My only worry, Sonny, there's going to be so much emotion around this match, and the theme basically is we must win for Senzo. And also, a win will take South Africa to the finals for the first time since 2008. I'm not counting 2013 because then they were hosts and qualified automatically. And with all that motion and desire to win, I hope that the players can remain calm because the Sudanese have proved to be pretty competitive. I think all our Nigerian listeners will vouch for that. They actually beat the Super Eagles in Khartoum. And they put up a pretty good account of themselves in Abuja before losing 3-1. And I don't envisage the Sudanese just coming to Durban and lying down and allowing the South Africans to run all over them. So we had a very sad occasion at the weekend. And then sort of the final farewell to Senzo will come with that match against Sudan.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. With more on South Africa's match against Sudan, here's our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
South African coach Ephraim Sheikhs Mashaba says they will seek to honor the memory of their slain captain Senzo Meiwa when they host Sudan in their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier next week. Mashaba made these remarks when he named a 26-member team for their remaining two Nations Cup qualifiers later this month. After Sudan, South Africa face African champions Nigeria, who will host them in Uyo, Akwa Ibom State, Nigeria. Algerian head of state Abdelaziz Bouteflika paid a glowing tribute to the Algerian club Entente Setif for winning the Orange Africa Champions League. He noted the triumph coincides with Algeria's celebration of the 60th anniversary of the outbreak of the country's National War of Liberation in 1954. President Bouteflika says Entente Setif's triumph demonstrates Algeria's faith in the future of their youth. Entente Setif first won the trophy in 1988. President Bouteflika assures Entente of Algeria's full support at the FIFA Club World Cup in Morocco next month. Meanwhile, Kenyan Robert Milton Kiplagat clocked 2 hours, 9 minutes and 4 seconds to win the Algiers Marathon in the Algerian capital. Fellow Kenyan Lawrence Cherono, then Ethiopian Robby Fikre Asefa, followed him across the finish line, while Tadesa Mestawat and Retsega Guleu made it a 1-2 Ethiopian triumph in the women's race ahead of Kenyan Sally Jepkemoi.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C.
The Voice of America.
VOA. Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America.
Ed Kowalski for the Classic Rock Show, where each week we spotlight the great album rock and roll of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Wednesday at 21 hours Universal Time. Join me for the Classic Rock Show, 21 hours Universal Time Wednesdays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.
And when you visit VOANews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled, Ugandan Lion Bogere Roars in 2014. It's been a very good year for Ugandan boxer Sharif the Lion Bogere, and his three victories over Mexican opponents have put him in good position for another world title shot in 2015. Bogere's most recent win came October 30th when he knocked out Fernando Garcia in the fifth round in Plymouth, Massachusetts, not far from Boston. The Ugandan Lion dominated the bout with his speed and power and he put Garcia down for the count with a 1-2 combination, finishing off the Mexican with a straight right hand. Now, this marked the first time the 26-year-old Bogueri has fought in Plymouth, a historic Massachusetts town founded by the Pilgrims way back in 1620. Plymouth also holds a special place in the heart of this sporty blogger. My parents are proud graduates of Plymouth High School's class of 1947. Sharif the Lion Bogueri, meanwhile, is a proud graduate of the School of Hard Knocks. He learned to fight as a little boy on the streets of Uganda's capital, Kampala. Bogueri says at a young age, he dreamed of moving to the USA, fighting professionally, and becoming a world champion. Now based in Las Vegas, Nevada, Bogueri got his first shot at a major world title last year in Vegas, where he lost a 12-round unanimous decision to Cuba's Richard Abril for the vacant WBA lightweight title. But the Ugandan Lion was hobbled against the Cuban. He hurt his Achilles tendon in one of the middle rounds, which limited his movement in the ring. After his first and only loss in 27 professional fights, Bogueri underwent successful surgery on the Achilles. And now, after a successful 2014, Bogueri is moving towards another world championship fight in 2015. Ugandan boxer Sharif the Lion Bogueri, the subject of the latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
Sunny, Babani, yes, Sunny Side of Sports, it's a program. Sunny, Babani, yes, Sunny Side of Sports, it's a program. Sunny, Babani, yes, Sunny Side of Sports, it's a program.
That little jingle you just heard is what greeted me during a rousing reception recently at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Lagos, Nigeria. Dr. Larry Zamajay and our Brilla broadcasting partners organized a jubilant jamboree outside their station in Nigeria's commercial capital. And speaking of jamborees, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports birthday salute to Ghanaian football great Abedi Pele. The three-time African Footballer of the Year is celebrating his 50th birthday today, Wednesday. Abedi Pele never had a chance to play at a World Cup, but two of his sons, Andre and Jordan, played for Ghana at this year's World Cup in Brazil. Happy 50th birthday, Abedi Pele. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, closed roads and canceled flights because of Ebola keep Liberians who have spent years abroad from returning home. And next, New York's African diaspora fear major economic repercussions here and in their homelands because of misinformation and panic about the Ebola virus. But first, some music. Here is Sierra Leone Swa with Africa.
Yeah, Africa. Africa now we mother land. We got to stop the fighting, raping. All over Africa, now war. How many children they suffer, people and they suffer and die. Innocent civilian and they die. Please, let we stop the fighting. Africa, let we unite, let we build Africa.
I take a look around, a beautiful Africa. Structures of poverty, war and crime is all that I see. I can't get it over with, my brothers killing one another. Sometimes I wonder if this is how we were meant to be. That's why
we sing the song for Africa, a song for peace and unity. We sing the song for Africa, a song for our motherland.
Akira, this is gone. Was of in Africa. Corruption in government is all we read about all day. The rate of illiteracy is going on the rampage. It's time we stand up high to save our beautiful Africa.
We sing the song for Africa, a song for peace.
Sierra Leone's Soa with Africa.
Well, refugees from Liberia's civil wars living in a camp outside of Ghana's capital, Accra, say they are eager to return home, but the lack of money they don't have to do so. Now there's another problem, Ebola, and the closed roads and canceled flights that have kept Liberians who have spent years abroad from returning. Chris Stein reports from Buduburum, Ghana.
Amos Boy fled Liberia 12 years ago as fighting engulfed the country. He wants to go back, but missed the organized repatriations carried out by the United Nations. He doesn't have the money to travel. But with Ebola killing more than 2,400 people across Liberia, he now knows that he might have to wait longer.
Right now, there's no flight that's going, and there's no road, no border open from Ghana to Liberia now. So before you get to Liberia, maybe it'll be a lot of means. I don't want to risk my life passing so many eras, illegal eras. Yeah, so I decided to wait.
The Buduburum refugee camp outside of Accra is now quieter than it once was. Many of the Liberians who fled to Ghana have returned home over the years, particularly after Liberians lost their status as refugees in 2012. But for those who remain, waiting is difficult. Trucks and buses used to set out from the camp on a five-day journey to Liberia. Now the cars are just sitting. Robert McIntosh, the secretary of the local Ghana Private Roads Transport Union, says the closed borders mean traders are losing money.
Now, as you can see, things are not the way it should be, because whenever cars are going from here, the place is packed. People are moving up and down. People are patronizing the business, moving in and out, moving in and out, but now it's not happening again. And we are actually worried about the situation of the customer who have kept the goods here for almost 3 months to 4 months. There's no way out for them. The goods are being packed in our trucks. The warehouse is full.
The news from home is frequently grim for those living in the camp. Ebola killed 6 of Peter Kaba's relatives in Liberia, 5 of whom died over the course of just a month.
I was called from Liberia that my older sister died from a sickness. But after the burial of my older sister, the older daughter of her died. From there, the little brother died. The older sister died again. There were 5 that died on the spot.
With borders closed and jobs scarce, many of the Liberians in the camp can only hope for conditions to improve before traveling back home. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bujumbura.
With Ebola screening now underway at major U.S. ports of entry, the threat of automatic quarantine and the possibility of an African travel ban, many in New York's African diaspora fear major economic repercussions here and in their homelands, as well as social ostracism based on misinformation and panic about the virus. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
For thousands of African immigrants living in America, a travel ban between the United States and Africa could prove catastrophic, says community leader Kofi Boateng, the Ghanaian-American director of the West Harlem Development Corporation.
Because it means they themselves are afraid or fear they may not be able to go back home to attend many important things such as funerals, attend to their businesses. A lot of the African diaspora involved in business transactions back home, and vice versa. It also means that even government officials who have to come and oversee trade missions, diplomatic activities, visit the community also can't come. It is fear.
Boateng says the Ebola scare has already affected livelihoods in Harlem. The district is dotted with braiding salons where women, mostly from West Africa, weave hair in the African style and apply hair extensions made from African hair. Boateng says these businesses have been losing customers at a growing rate over the past 2 months, even though many of the women working there have not visited their homelands for years. Similarly, many West African taxi drivers report being shunned by New Yorkers who fear that their cab interiors may transmit the Ebola virus. Neither fear is justified by the science. Yet despite repeated announcements from public health officials about how Ebola is and is not transmitted, Boateng says the information does not seem to be getting through.
So the Africans are afraid that when issues such as travel ban and misinformation about how you contract the disease take hold, then before they know it, their kids will be thrown out of school, they themselves will lose their jobs, their family members can't get visas.
Adding to the community's distress is the realization that traditional West African customs must be modified, at least for now. Treatment of the dead and dying is one arena, says Boateng, who is helping to organize local forums to inform his community, who may in turn educate loved ones back home. In America, over 2/3 of deaths occur in hospitals and other institutional settings. The bodies are typically transported to funeral homes, where they are washed and prepared for burial. In Africa, by contrast, most people die at home, and it's customary for family and community members to touch, kiss, wash, and bury the bodies themselves. But when a person has died of Ebola, contact with their body fluids puts mourners at high risk. Boateng and other leaders recommend that for now, that custom should change. They also warn about the extended handshaking that's deeply ingrained in African culture, especially at public events like weddings and funerals. These days, Boateng says, respectful eye contact and a wave must suffice. A publicity campaign in Nigeria advocated exactly that, and it seems to have changed people's behavior. Making these and other changes is a step forward, says Chika Onyani, editor and publisher of the widely read diaspora newspaper African Sun-Times. But he notes that battling the Ebola epidemic is no longer just Africa's problem.
Somebody died in Spain, somebody died in Germany, and somebody died in the U.S. It's a worldwide problem now. So let us all unite. Let's not stigmatize a group of people for what is happening. Let us all work together.
Indications of progress are mixed. On Friday, two Bronx schoolboys from Senegal were beaten up by fellow students yelling Ebola, while downtown, Manhattan's Bellevue Hospital's isolation ward admitted New York City's first Ebola patient. The United Nations reports that an international fund it has set up to fight Ebola has collected just under half of its $1 billion goal. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On the eve of planned peace talks between the South Sudanese government and rebels contesting its authority, government troops and rebel soldiers are clashing again. Fighting flared around the town of Bentiu in Unity State, a hub of one of the nation's key oil-producing regions. Control of the area is uncertain, with both sides claiming the upper hand in the skirmish. The two sides are due to hold a fresh round of talks in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, though the start date is uncertain yet. The United States condemns in the strongest terms the latest attacks by Sudan People's Liberation Movement Army in opposition in and around Bentiu. Despite the party's recent acceptance of collective responsibility for the crisis, these current attacks demonstrate that the group has yet to abandon violence to achieve its goals. We call on both sides to ensure their forces refrain from further actions that violate the January 23rd secession of hostilities agreement and undermine the peace process in South Sudan. More than 1.4 million people in South Sudan have fled their homes since December, when a political dispute between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar erupted into armed conflict, later escalating into widespread intercommunal violence. Commanders from both sides have been sanctioned for human rights abuses and violating a ceasefire that was signed in January. As the conflict persists and the humanitarian crisis continues to reach even more appalling levels, it is more urgent than ever to respect previous agreements to end the hostilities, cease the recruitment and mobilization of forces, including that of child soldiers, and engage earnestly in inclusive negotiations. No party should use these latest attacks as an excuse not to engage in the peace process or not to work in good faith to negotiate all necessary elements of a sustainable political transition, achieve a sustainable peace, and restore national unity. We remind all parties of the need to guarantee that unmissed sites and personnel are protected and that UN and other humanitarian agencies have safe, unfettered access to people in need of assistance. The United States remains committed to the people of South Sudan and is determined to hold accountable those who choose violence, standing ready to place sanctions on those who obstruct peace, commit human rights abuses and violations, and block humanitarian assistance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.